Keith, while you're getting ready, I'd like to say a word for our Jesus. Mm-hmm. I noticed that song was copyrighted in 1964, and that was the year I was born. And it just makes me think about life. I'm thankful for those who are faithful in their lives, in their everyday lives, and living for Jesus, that somewhere along the way, a light came across my path, and I had the opportunity to trust in Him. I don't know where I would be today without Jesus, but I'm not going to be happy, and I wouldn't have joy in my heart. I wouldn't have peace. Thankful that He loves me.
Amen. The word for Jesus is always in order. Anybody else have one burning on their heart tonight? Well, we've been looking at Abraham in Genesis on Wednesday night. And the last time we did, we were in chapter 14, 15. There we go. So here in chapter 15, at the end of it anyway, we have this account of a type of apparently covenant ceremony that God commanded Abram to go through in response to Abram's question of God. In verse 8, and he said, Lord God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? Now, we are going to take a little rabbit trail tonight, as we call it. Have you ever heard of covenant theology? Heard that term? Yeah.
Does that know what the covenanters?
Perhaps at some point, covenanters, that word, probably not the
Church of the Bible Covenant.
Church of the Bible Covenant, if you're thinking of that.
I'm sorry, I was thinking of the Scottish
covenant. Likely, yes. Yeah. There are many manifestations of it in different degrees, and but one of the things that you encounter when you encounter somebody that is processing, it's basically a way to process Scripture. It's a way to divide it up and to put everything in its place. And largely associated with Reformed theology. And I've got a blog post here, which gives you a little snapshot of it in common terms. As you might expect, if you want to know in detail about any aspect of theology, it gets a little thick after a while and technical and all that. And I don't imagine you're up to that tonight. I know I'm not. So we'll go with a Covenant Theology for Dummies version here. How's that? And I'm with you here. This is somewhat of a simplification to give you an idea of the type of thinking that's going on here. Two kinds of covenants in the Bible you need to know. There are two kinds of covenants in the Bible. And every person needs to know them. If you're an adult, you have likely signed a contract at some point in time, perhaps for purchase or to participate in an event of some kind. We find various contracts throughout the Bible, but they are usually called covenants. In order to understand how God makes and keeps His promises, We need to look at the biblical meaning of covenants because they're involved in all the major parts of the biblical story. Okay, so this is somebody who is going to process everything in the Bible in terms of covenants. And I don't want to come across as overly negative in reading it, but I do have just some... when I first encountered it, I immediately have a bit of hesitation because of the process of taking a word and making it the center of the Bible. For instance, if we just talk about a covenant, there's nothing magical about a covenant. It's just an agreement between people. Lawyers know all about covenants, more than you probably like to know. And it's used in legal language in our world. But let's go ahead and do this here. Let's think for a minute about why you might enter into a covenant with somebody. Why would you make an agreement with somebody? Let's see. Let's suppose that... Well, just give me an example. Why would you make an agreement with anybody?
Do you want to rob somebody?
Okay. So somebody has something... resources in terms of money, and you don't. And you would like to use their resources. And so, in order to do that... there usually has to be an agreement. For one, there's the understanding that you're going to pay it back someday, right? Because if you're the one with the money and you worked hard for it, might be all you got. And so you would like it to be perfectly clear, yes, I'll let you use this, but then our agreement is that you will... I need to know what to expect from you. What are you going to do with this? Is this... Do I say goodbye, farewell to the money, or do I expect it back in some orderly, timely fashion?
So stipulate how, usually on a monthly basis.
Okay, there you are. You already have an idea how you want this agreement to work. And... on the borrowing end, yes, sure.
But you need a covenant when one person is going to do something with the expectation that somebody else is going to do something, and oftentimes separated in time. If I extend myself in some way, then you are agreeing to extend yourself in some way, that is some reciprocal, you did for me, I do for you, something. I need money, you give me the money, I'll pay you back the money with interest. There's your loan. So I did something for you, added interest to what I paid you back in order for you to let me use your money now.
Mm-hmm.
There's always some reciprocity. If you will, then I will.
Okay.
Marriage is often considered a covenant vow.
Okay. From a legal standpoint, would you consider marriage a covenant vow?
Yeah, unfortunately, the law allows it to be broken pretty easily.
So it's a covenant that can be broken under certain terms?
Yeah.
Or in certain conditions?
Probably, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's hard to say yes to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so, but let's look at it too. What types of entities require covenants?
People who don't necessarily can't really just trust each other. You have to get down to secure your interests.
Okay, but even if you do trust somebody,
accountability.
A covenant gives. I mean, it involves a commitment, which hopefully there's ways to make accountability happen after that. So accountability is an issue within this, but. Okay. But like, what kind of entities make covenants? Do rocks make covenants?
No, humans.
Those with will.
Those who have an independent will. That's where you need a covenant, because you don't know what's going to happen. This other person may have an idea of, well, you know, I like your money and I've got a place for it, and this works for me. But you have a will too, and you had the money to start with, and so a covenant is between independent wills. That's why you need it. Otherwise, you wouldn't. If somebody is totally dependent, there's no need for a covenant, because they're not going to do anything that you don't want. You don't make covenants with robots.
Or with a baby. Well, I guess they have a will. Sorry. Not a good analogy.
Right. They're not old enough to be accountable. So I think that's important to notice. That's why we have covenants, so that people of independent wills have an understanding, have an agreement. This is how we're going to conduct ourselves in this area of life. Okay? So you have covenants on property sometimes. You have a neighborhood which is part of a neighborhood covenant, which says, if I live here, I can't burn my trash outside. Probably won't do it inside either, but anyway. Or whatever. I can't build a doghouse higher than 3 stories or whatever. Yeah. And no 2-story outhouses. But those kind of things could be involved in a covenant. But they're agreements, because people do have independent wills. Okay. So it's just a word. It's a word which describes an interaction, entering into a certain kind of committed relationship. Now, what is the impetus for keeping a covenant? If I enter into a covenant with you, why do I keep it?
So you can get what you want. To be honest.
You want your money back.
Okay, so like if I'm the lender, I do it because I want my money back. I mean, I but after I do it, it's kind of out of my hands. So, but the other guy, why does he do it? There may be penalties, right? The covenant may involve these penalties. But most fundamentally, when I enter into a covenant, I am making a statement about reality. I am saying, I am a kind of person that will behave in this way in the future at specified times in specified places, and that's how reality will unfold with me. That's what I'm going to do with my will. If I don't do that, then I am revealed as a person who is not truthful, who doesn't have a reliable hold on reality, perhaps. But there's a major disconnect here between what is real and what I said in my covenant. So, another important aspect of how covenants work and why we make them and why we want to keep them. Okay, so back to this blog post. We find various contracts throughout the Bible. Okay. It's easy to overlook the word covenant since it sounds antiquated and out of date, but understanding this word is the key to making sense of the entire Bible. There are 2 main types of covenants in the Bible, conditional and unconditional. Let's first look at both by using examples from everyday life today. Later, we can apply these distinctions to biblical covenants. Okay, so here's a contention. There are 2 types of covenants, conditional and unconditional. I don't know if you know where this is going, but there are theological reasons for wanting to say that. Mm-hmm. What is a conditional covenant? A conditional covenant is an agreement between 2 or more parties that requires certain conditions to be met. If the terms are met, there will be one kind of result. If the terms are not met, there will be a different result. Here are some examples of conditional covenants. Now, in fact, there don't have to be stated both positive and negative results. A conditional agreement can just give you the conditions, not necessarily damages or whatever. So the claim is this is a conditional covenant. A company hires a contractor to construct an office building for a certain amount of money. If the contractor fails to complete the building as laid out in the contract agreement, the company will withhold payment to the contractor. Okay? So, if you do what the contract says, you will be paid. Second example, a woman hires an accountant to help her filing a tax return. Imagine that. She shows up for the appointment, but the accountant chooses to spend extra time with another client and misses the appointment. The woman decides to fire the accountant and hire someone else who is more reliable. Now, do you see that as an example of a covenant? It's not a very good example, I don't think. Because there's no agreement. When you make an appointment, how many people make an appointment with a doctor, for instance, say a dentist, and expect to get in at exactly the minute of the appointment? Now, some dentists may do this, I don't know. But most doctors I know, appointment times are suggestions, right? And you don't feel like there's been a breach of contract if you're 30 minutes late. You're lucky if you're not an hour late in some cases. So that's not really an example of a covenant, but I understand this attempt here is to make it accessible, but you might ought to be a little more accurate in the process. Anyway, I don't like that example. In both cases, some type of work was expected on the part of a certain person in order to get a certain result. These conditional covenants are also called covenants of works.
Oh, boy. We're loading it up.
And who calls these covenants of works? Lawyers everywhere, right? No. Those who are using covenant theology as a basis for understanding the Bible. And so if there's any kind of condition, then it is a covenant of works. Now, I do resent the approach of just suggesting that I'm presenting the Bible here. I'm presenting the raw truth. This is the nature of reality. This is huge spin, okay? This is a lot of processing going here on here, and this isn't Bible 101. But anyway, we know what's going to happen here. If it's a conditional covenant, we can classify it that way, then it's a covenant of works. While the Mosaic Covenant was an administration of the unconditional Abrahamic covenant of grace, so you saw that coming, right? Covenant of works, covenant of grace. It had a conditional aspect in respect to the physical land promise. The people of Israel needed to keep the stipulations of the covenant in order to stay in the promised land. They repeatedly broke the covenant and were eventually sent into exile. And so we have some scriptures thrown in here along the way. For thus says the Lord God, I will also do with you as you have done, you who have despised the oath by breaking the covenant. From Ezekiel. Okay, so covenant of works, covenant of grace. What is an unconditional covenant? An unconditional covenant is an agreement between two or more parties that involves no stipulations of any kind for fulfillment of the agreement. Okay, here are two examples of unconditional covenants. The first one, a father and mother promise unconditionally to pay for college in full for their child. The child's grades and general behavior cannot affect the keeping of the promise. Even if the child is a poor student, disrespectful, or involved with drugs, the parents must follow through on their commitment. Where do you find parents like that?
they're out there.
That's far-fetched. Okay. First of all, it isn't unconditional, because if the child dies, you're not going to pay for the college education. If the child is brain damaged in a coma, you're not going to pay for the child's education. There would be a number of circumstances that you can imagine that it would be impossible to even get them in college, unless you're in Hollywood. And then having a brain damage might qualify you to be on the rowing team. I don't know. That's sad. But again, not a good example of what you're... The second one is, a person bequeaths property to another person in a will or testament with no conditions needing to be fulfilled by the recipient to receive the property.
Not a good example.
Okay. Could you expand on that a little bit, why that is not a good example of an unconditional...
Will or testament can be changed up until the moment of death. Once the moment of death occurs, then it's not a promise to do anything. Not a covenant or a contract to do anything. It's just a gift.
It's already been done.
Yes, right. It's just a matter of delivery. But that's not really a covenant to do anything. Nobody's promised to do anything. And kind of interesting, in law, you can't make an enforceable promise to make a future gift. I had a client wanting to do that recently in a business transaction, and I said, you can't do that in an enforceable way. Basically, he wanted it to be a gift instead of compensation for something. I said, you can't do that. So an unconditional covenant, the way they're describing it, is a promise to make a future gift.
There really isn't no such thing as an unconditional covenant. You may come up with somebody, you're going to have some conditions to it.
Well, you clearly are not on board with covenant theology. I'm with you there, Larry. But
tell me one that you have that doesn't have specifications that you've got to do something with it.
Well, we'll examine Abraham here in a minute, because they claim that that is an example of that, and I don't think it is. And we'll kind of look at the data and see, and I think you'll be right there, Larry. I don't know if it's not possible. It seems odd. The question is, why are you still calling it a covenant? You know, in the case of a will is a decision which is made by somebody before they die what they're going to do with their stuff. Where's the covenantal aspect of that? Why? The only reason you call that a covenant is if you have decided to describe everything in those terms, and then you have to invent a new kind of covenant. Oh, it's an unconditional covenant.
And what if the recipient doesn't agree to it?
Right.
They get it. Sorry. You know? You're going to get my cat. We're all 20 of them.
More money than you're going to give me. You know, yeah, there's no covenant. I'm done.
I mean, I think that's what Beck is saying. It can't be a covenant because the person doesn't agree or disagree.
Well, okay, but the idea here is, okay, I say, Laura, I want us to agree together that when I die, you get all my scrap iron. Now, you probably wouldn't agree to that, but you might. If I changed it to grand piano.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So we have an agreement, in a sense, but why call it a covenant? It's not naturally that kind of agreement. But not only do they enshrine the notion of an unconditional covenant, but they give it a special name. An unconditional covenant is known as a covenant of grace. And I'm sure in the case of the scrap iron, you would not consider me be particularly gracious if I gave that to you. Or a grant. In unconditional covenants, agreement by both parties is not necessary. Okay, I mean, if you're defining your own terms, you can do it how you want, right? So, one party makes an oath to another person and keeps it, regardless of the opinion, wants of the other party. The Abrahamic covenant is an example of an unconditional covenant. There was nothing Abraham could do to break the covenant God made with him.
We're trusting God.
Just based on the passages, though, what you know, that's what they're suggesting, that God didn't, down the road from his initial experience with Abraham, he didn't say, I'm going to do this if you do such and such. So the temptation is to say, well, he didn't have to do anything. But that's what I want to examine here in Abraham, just to see how involved Abraham was and whether this so-called unconditional covenant was in fact done regardless of Abraham's behavior, at least at some point in history. Okay, I think this is about over. So there's a quote from Genesis 15, which we have in our Bibles as well. All people, both Christians and non-Christians, need to know whether a biblical covenant is conditional or unconditional, because this distinction determines its meaning for them personally today. Okay, so you got a little feel for what we're talking about here. But what I'd like to examine with you tonight is whether it would be accurate to categorize the interactions between God and Abraham as an unconditional covenant, as they have here defined it. If we go back to where we first encounter this relationship, it is in Genesis 12. And this follows the report that Abram had gone with his father and with Lot, his nephew, and with Sarai, his wife, unto Haran, and dwelt there until his father died. So then chapter 12 commences with these words. Now the Lord said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, into a land that I will show thee. I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. Stop. If Abraham would not have gone into the land of Canaan, do you think God would have kept this promise? Is there any reason to suggest that this is some sort of one-sided thing, so that whether Abraham did this or not, if he would have just hung out there in Haran, or Haran, don't remember how I pronounced it last time we read it, and gotten involved in the worship of other gods, and not have had a living trust in Jehovah, would God have carried this promise out? I don't think so.
He probably got zapped.
He probably got zapped. at any rate, he would not have been blessed in the way that God blessed him. The implication here is, if you do this, he says, come out of this land, depart from this place, and then I will bless you. It seems to me that there's a very strong condition there. It's because he did what God said that he became the father of many nations. So then, I have over here on the side all the times where God then repeats this promise to Abraham. And so, down here in verse 7, when he gets into the land of Canaan, the Lord appeared unto Abram and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. And there he builded an altar unto the Lord who appeared to him. Okay, so this is a continuation of the conversation that was started before Abraham left his homeland. And because he had obeyed God, because he had trusted in God, God then made a decision for the future. You are going to be the one in whom the world is blessed. The Messiah is going to be coming through your offspring. So, it was based on the condition of what Abraham did. But now that he's done it, there's no more, well, if you get out of your land, then I'm going to do it. He's already done it. And we have evidence that he continued to follow God. But God didn't tell him at every step along the way, now, if you don't do this, then I won't do that. Because he was on the road. He was going that way. And at every chance in his life where he could have not done what God wanted, for instance, when God said, I want you to sacrifice your son Isaac, Abraham doesn't seem to have bucked a bit. I'm sure he was heavy-hearted. He didn't know how this was all going to work out. But he was trusting God. So it became a mark of his life from then on. And so, you know, the thing about covenants, if you're legal-minded, you love covenants. Because covenants put the other party where they are highly predictable. Unless they want to break it, which is bad. No, no, don't do that.
But you can easily judge where they're at. They have broken this or this or this.
Covenants are lawyers' dreams, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. If there's no contract, it gets real fuzzy. And, of course, that can be a dream, too, just more legal fees, but that's beside the point. if you're wanting to be on the winning side without having to fudge the facts, you want a covenant. You want a contract. And so, as opposed to that kind of relationship, God's leading of Abraham was a bit open-ended. Abraham didn't know where God was going to take him, right? There was that initial come out of the land, but then we see all through his life, there's this decision and that decision, and he has to continue trusting God. And God didn't say, look, if you do this, then you know here's the carrot. It wasn't that kind of a legalistic relationship. It was a relationship of trust. And so just the very nature of the relationship makes the use of the legalistic language objectionable to me. But we're looking here at how this is recorded in Genesis as to how God continues to repeat these promises. So then in verse 14 of chapter 12, and the Lord said unto Abraham after that Lot was departed from him, this is chapter 13, I'm sorry, lift up now thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art, northward, and southward, and eastward, and westward. For all the land which thou seest, I will give to thee, and to thy seed forever. And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. Is this a new covenant? This is a repetition, isn't it? He's repeating what he told him to start with, more or less. This is not a new thing. We come down to Genesis 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram in a vision, saying, fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. And he brought him forth abroad and said, look now toward the heaven and tell the stars if thou be able to number them. And he said unto him, so shall thy seed be. And he believed in God, and he counted it to him for righteousness. So right here in the middle of all this, we have a very strong statement where somebody is doing something. That sounds frighteningly like works, doesn't it? Of course, we get away with that in the New Testament by making faith a gift of God. It's not mentioned here in this case. It just says that his belief in God was counted by God as righteousness in him. No indication that God gave him that. And he said unto him, I am the Lord that brought thee out of Ur of the Chaldees to make this land, to give thee this land to inherit it. And he said, Lord God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? Okay, so that brings us to the passage that we were just reading when we started tonight about the ceremony of the sacrifice. So God gave him a covenant-type ceremony to reinforce his belief. We might argue that, well, why didn't Abraham need that? I don't know. God didn't chide him for it. But that's what we have. That's what happened there in chapter 15. A little farther here, then we'll jump ahead in Genesis 17, which we haven't read yet. And when Abram was 90 years old and nine, the Lord appeared unto Abram and said unto him, I am the Almighty God. Walk before me and be thou perfect. Now, that's not really there. Just skip over that. And I will make my covenant between me and thee, and I will multiply thee exceedingly. Okay, it would be real easy to suggest that there is a connection here between how you're walking and the covenant that I'm making. Wouldn't you say? And Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, As for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham. For a father of many nations have I made thee. And I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee. And I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed and thee and their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. And God said unto Abram, Thou shalt keep my covenant, therefore, thou and thy seed after thee in their generations. Okay, it seems like sometime tonight I read some sort of language about the unconditional covenant of grace that was also the Abrahamic covenant involved a grant and didn't require anybody to do anything except the one giving it. Once again, the author of the Old Testament must not have been a covenant theology theologian, because he is careless with his words here. If he were, because he says, Thou shalt keep my covenant, therefore, thou and thy seed after thee in their generations.
And the ones that ascribe to this idea, seems to be pretty clear that there is there is a requirement. I haven't read
They would see that probably, and I don't know specifically, but they would probably see that as looking ahead to the Mosaic covenant, which was the covenant of works. And so under that, there was this exchange. There was this, if you do this, then I will do that, and if you don't, I won't. And they would say that, you have some of these passages where God just says, I will give you this. Look at this land, I will give you this. And in that particular succession of verses, he doesn't say anything about if you do something. Okay? And, well, let's look at the article where what was quoted here. Let's see. It's This one.
Like above, further up.
Well, I thought...
right at the top of the page is pretty much it.
So here's the Abrahamic covenant is an example of an unconditional covenant. There was nothing Abraham could do to break the covenant God made with him. And they quote Genesis 15, where he says, "On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham and said, 'To your descendants I give this land.'" So in that expression, it doesn't say anything about if you do anything. But he had already done something. Right? That's my argument. The fact that God doesn't point back and say, well, because of this, every time he says this, doesn't mean that Abraham is not an active participant in this agreement.
Why does that have you awaken right here? It says, "Thou shalt keep my covenant."
You need to get online, Steve, and argue with some of these people. Wouldn't take long to get a lively discussion going.
I think you can comment on that blog.
It is particularly important that the Abrahamic covenant be a covenant of grace, because of what?
Jesus Christ. Is that what you're thinking of?
Mm-hmm. The Apostle Paul pictures Abraham as the archetypal example of what God's pleased with and the kind of relationship that we are to have with God. So as Abraham's faith was accounted to him for righteousness, Paul talks about in Romans, therefore salvation is by faith. If you can't make Abraham's covenant a covenant of grace in some sense, then you have to really wiggle, because they need that. And so, but you know, if you're not familiar with the language, you hear this for the first time, it's like all this stuff is being thrown at you, all these verses. And in fact, let me just give you a quick idea of how thick this can get. There are a whole number of covenants that are then discovered once you start looking. And so seven specific covenants, according to this source. And so you have the Adamic covenant, the Noahic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, the Palestinian covenant, the Mosaic covenant, the Davidic covenant, and the New Covenant. You didn't know that, did you? And suddenly you begin to feel overwhelmed. I mean, all this stuff in the Bible I didn't even know about. And maybe I've got the wrong version. I don't know. But when you start looking at specifics, and this is true in all of life, there are many times whenever you're going to feel overwhelmed by things which are new and different to you. Just stop and start looking at the details. Look at the assumptions. Look at the definitions. Do they really hold up? And there may be times whenever you have to change because you didn't thoroughly enough analyze and study or whatever. You weren't given the kind of insights you needed. But there's going to be plenty of times when you find that when you start looking at the details, it's not like it appears at first. And this is certainly one of those cases. Case in point, if we start looking at these covenants, notice what they're calling a covenant with regard to Adam. So this covenant is found in Genesis 1, verses 26 through 30. What does Genesis 1, 26 through 30 say? It said, and God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image, and the image of God created him, male and female created he them. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth there upon the earth. And so, where's the covenant?
I'm giving you a reply.
You said you didn't want to be created.
Yeah. Don't make me boss. I want that dominion stuff. You know, we've agreed that we're going to talk about everything in terms of covenant. So here, I mean, this is an account of what God did. God said, this is my purpose in the earth, and this is what I'm going to accomplish, and here I'm going to do it. And we're going to call that a covenant too. He says to man, this is what I'm giving you, and this is what you can do. That seems to me a bit of a stretch. Once again, it's because you're wanting to use the language, and you're going to find a way to do it. Then we have chapter 2, verses 16 and 17. Let's give it. Yes.
Being Adam, God was saying that to himself. He wasn't talking to Adam.
Maybe the covenant was among the Trinity, huh? So in 16 and 17, we have, and the Lord God commanded man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest eat freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die.
That's a command.
If you make the definition of covenant loose enough, you might be able to do that, but isn't it much more clear and suitable for language to say God gave man a command than that he entered into a covenant with him? Not the best use of language in my mind. And so there's one more. Whoops. Oh, yeah, I know where I am.
That one.
Thank you. Genesis 3:15. What have we here? And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Okay, so once again, God telling what he's going to do. Unless you're just needing to use covenant language, that's not a natural way to describe that.
Do you think they were thinking we wouldn't look it up or something? It doesn't make any. I'm really having a hard time connecting dots, even in an obscure way.
And what's the purpose of using covenant language? I mean, what's behind it all?
Well, certain aspects of Reformed theology tend to sort of come naturally out of it. It's a way of understanding. For instance, in trying to incorporate the transition from Old Testament to New Testament, in trying to reinforce the concept that there's absolutely nothing you can do for your own salvation, that God does it all. The idea is that God has an unconditional covenant with man. And in an unconditional covenant, the one party doesn't do anything. It doesn't matter what they do. So what comes out of that naturally then is, once you're saved, you're always saved. You don't have to keep the covenant of that kind of a covenant because it's unconditional.
You have to add to the story to get there.
It seems like it. Yeah. Yeah.
And Abraham would be a bad example. I mean, obedience to the point of killing your child or leaving everything comfortable that you know. That's that is some serious obedience.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yes. But, you know, there was a time in history whenever the demon of good works seemed so threatening that it was necessary to totally obliterate it. And so, as a result, we swing on the pendulum, right? And things don't really resemble what you get when you come back here. Which is why it's important we come back here. And whenever references are quoted, look up those references and read those references. Do those references really say what they claim to be having said? Okay. Well, a little taste of covenant theology. And if you still thirst for it, there's tons of stuff online. You can read yourself silly.
They don't want to hear from me.
Yep.
Well, this is helpful because, I mean, I know in the homeschool movement, our young people will face this stuff. We did in the early days. It was so foreign to us. We didn't even recognize it for what it was.
And a word of caution, keep in mind that somebody that believes this finds it to be a very beautiful thing. If you put it in certain terms, it has certain appeal. And so don't expect your skepticism or your disbelief that anybody believes it to come across when you're dealing with somebody else, because it may well be a precious notion.
And what I've wondered too, there are, as you look through history, so much of this particular movement produced so much of what, you know, our hymns are filled.
Mm-hmm.
If you look carefully, they actually are filled with this perspective, in a not exactly covenant theology, but I mean just the more reformed kind.
Mm-hmm.
And so much art, there's just, they produce so much. Because they give a structure to the world that a lot of evangelicalism has come to lose. So just trying to understand how to connect with some very dear people that have been raised in this.
Well, to me, the best path is just to agree that let's just all sit down and examine what's here, you know, rather than jump on a bandwagon of any kind and do it because it's always been done. Although, due respect for tradition and history is important, but whenever you go to the source and it's just not there, then you travel at your own peril if you insist on repeating it.
One very worth repeating thing that was said in that blog post was the very last line said, understanding these things has a serious impact on your personal life or something like that. Yeah, it does.
Yes.
I don't take it quite the way the writer meant it, but mm-hmm. it really does. What you think of eternal security, for example,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing, can't help but play out in your life, and it will lead you to different ways of living.
Yes. All right. Well, Lord willing, next time we get together, we'll do some more Abraham. And we'll be beyond covenant theology.